So welcome to Lungcast, the monthly respiratory health podcast series from the American Lung Association and medical news site HCP Live. I'm your host, Dr. Albert Rizzo, Chief Medical Officer of the American Lung Association. Before we get into today's topic, we want to remind you how you can enjoy Lungcast. We're over on YouTube, where you can subscribe to our channel at Lungcast to get updates on new episodes and interview segments. You can also subscribe to us on Apple Podcasts and Spotify. You can also get more Lungcast episode insights and segments at both hcplive.com and lung.org. Today's episode is our first foray into lung cancer in 2024. But while some of our latest interviews on cancer have fixed on screening and diagnostics, today we're talking about an exciting emerging drug class with one of the most prominent investigators involved with its clinical utility. We know that lung cancer is the leading cause of cancer death, with about 5 to 5 year survival after diagnosis of around 20%. It's also recognized as one of the most preventable cancer types. Survival is clearly associated with the cancer stage, and lung cancer screening in a high-risk population has been shown to be able to reduce lung cancer-related mortality, mainly because of stage shifting to early disease at the time of diagnosis. Currently, it's estimated approximately 20 to 25% of patients who receive a diagnosis of non-small cell lung cancer are at an early stage, and that can benefit from curative surgical resection at the time of that diagnosis. Anatomical surgical resection with systemic mediastinal lymph node dissection is currently the mainstay of therapy with these early stage non-small cell lung cancers with a goal of cure. However, 30 to 55% of these patients who undergo this curative surgery have recurrence and ultimately die of their disease. And because of this recurrence, therapeutic options are being pursued to address this. This includes the role of perioperative neoadjuvant treatment, whose aim includes reducing tumor size, increasing operability, and also eradicating micrometastases and reducing the rate of recurrence in these early stage diseases. Now, to learn more about the role of neoadjuvant therapy for lung cancer surgery, we have with us today Dr. Jonathan Spicer, who is Medical Director for McGill University Thoracic Oncology Network. Dr. Spicer has been involved with and published on some of the pivotal trials in assessing the role of adding immunotherapy as perioperative neoadjuvant therapy in non-small cell lung cancer. These articles have appeared in the New England Journal of Medicine in both May of 2022 and more recently in August of 2023. Thank you for being with us today, Dr. Spicer.
Thank you for having me. It's a pleasure.
A question or two before we get to those studies. I mentioned that the importance of stage shifting in early disease as a result from low-dose CT screening. Would you please explain some of the current experience in Canada with low-dose CT screening? In the United States, the rates continue to be lower than we would like and only slowly increasing, which is frustrating for such a potentially life-saving test.
Yeah, you know, we've been working on this for quite some time, a lot like what's been going on in the U.S. In Canada, healthcare tends to be provincially adjudicated, so we have some provinces that are further down the road of having formally established screening programs. Ontario was the first to get that afoot. Now we have one that is on the verge of being deployed here in Quebec, and there are several other provinces that are moving in that direction. We definitely see those patients coming through, but because we're still so early in the deployment of this pretty broad effort, I don't know that we've really generated statistics to know where we stand, say, in comparison to some of the efforts in the States. There's no doubt that getting patient engagement for these types of efforts continues to be a challenge. We see that, but there are more and more patients coming through our clinics who've been identified through these efforts and for whom we're offering, you know, exactly as you've described, an opportunity for curative treatment.
So just to level set for our audience, can you speak to the evolution of adjuvant and neoadjuvant therapy when it comes to lung cancer surgical therapy and explain the perceived benefits and maybe some of the potential risks of this approach?
Well, our efforts, I get, and I say the big R with a big O, you know, have been longstanding for many years. And I always quote the first couple of studies in the early 90s. The one was out of the Spanish cooperative group led by Rafael Rosell, and the other one was led by the MD Anderson group with Jack Roth. And those two studies published in 1994 showed that when you added chemotherapy to surgery for stage three disease, you just had a very dramatic impact in terms of survival. And both those trials actually had to be stopped halfway through because of the benefits of adding a systemic treatment to a local modality. And then really 30 years have gone by of trying to pair all of the different options, surgery, chemo, radiation, and then an introduction of new treatments into that mix. But it's been sort of rearranging chairs for 30 years. Do you give it before? Do you give it after? And it's what do you give? Is surgery really required? What's the role of radiation? And I would say there's been nothing truly definitive up until more recently in that space. There have been incremental steps forward, but I think we're kind of it's been very exciting because we're in a period where we're really starting to see the benefits of all the innovations that are happening in the metastatic setting now influencing what's happening in early stages. Because we recognize that issue, that such a, despite our efforts to properly stage patients and say, oh, okay, this is localized disease, it's curable, we're still struggling to really tease out who are the ones who have micrometastasis, who need these treatments to prevent a subsequent recurrence. And who are the ones who do just fine with a purely local therapy?
Yeah, I was surprised to see that statistic of 30 to 50% of people with stage one having surgery still have a recurrence rate of that high, which is concerning and certainly speaks for why you've developed some of the treatments you have. I mentioned those studies earlier on. Do you want to talk more about those studies and mention the role in guiding how these therapeutic options are being used in your lung cancer patients?
Yeah, so I mean, I was really fortunate to be a part of the CheckMate 816 trial, which is, I think, that the one that you mentioned that was published in 2022. It was pivotal because it really was the first neoadjuvant trial, so meaning giving a systemic treatment before the operation to finish, to complete its accrual, which has been a problem in that space, partly due to the logistics of obtaining the correct staging and the tissue to be able to give a systemic treatment like chemo. But it was one of those first ones to complete and be positive for two important endpoints. One was the rate of pathological complete response, meaning that after completion of preoperative therapy and surgery, pathologist looks at the specimen and sees that there is no cancer left, so that the preoperative treatment has sort of dealt with it before he even went to the OR. And the second endpoint was event-free survival, which is a sort of a composite endpoint of progression, precluding surgery, recurrence after completion of the treatment phase, or death. And both of those were very significantly improved in the trial. And really, kind of, I think a light bulb went off for a lot of teams around the world, seeing that this is something that they could implement in their care pathways and might open an opportunity for surgery for a lot of patients that they weren't considering surgeries for, mostly in the stage three category.
And that trial did include some early stage patients, or was that all stage three?
So it was predominant. It was about two-thirds stage three, and the remaining third stage two patients. Or in the original trial design, it was the AJCC seventh edition, which kind of goes from 1B to 3A. But if you were to apply the eighth edition to that same group, it would be 2A to 3B. So they're kind of all a collection of locally advanced patients
Got it.
to varying degrees, but our like stage 1A patients were not part of that trial.
And were these patients the ones that included the immunotherapy, or was that the other trial that
So CheckMate 816 randomized patients in an open label fashion to three cycles of chemotherapy with nivolumab, which is a checkpoint inhibitor, versus chemotherapy alone, both of which were then followed by surgery. Patients could get adjuvant treatment according to investigator choice, and then we're followed for survival. No further treatment after that, until death or recurrence. So it was one of the nice aspects of that trial is there was a very small amount of additional treatment over an accepted standard of preoperative chemo followed by surgery. It's just those three doses of immunotherapy, and we now have 3 and soon 4 year data on this trial showing durable benefits in terms of that event-free survival with only that short exposure treatment. And so, cost-benefit perspective, it was very appealing. There was minimal difference in adverse events. So that was an exciting effort. But then more recently, I don't know if you want me to go on and talk about KEYNOTE-67. So there's been a whole wave of trials. I've been part of a couple of them, but there are many expanding the effort to not just give this immunotherapy before, but also continue the treatment after. There was preclinical data to suggest that if you compared, in mice, purely preoperative treatment of immunotherapy versus a purely postoperative treatment versus a perioperative treatment, that the perioperative treatment was winning out. And so this was tested in clinical trials where perioperative immunotherapy, so in combination with chemo before surgery, then adjuvant monotherapy, just the immunotherapy on its own afterwards for up to a year versus preoperative chemotherapy and surgery alone, which of the two was better. And so unsurprisingly, the patients who got immunotherapy did better. And so I think, and this was the case for KEYNOTE-671 that we published, that Dr. Wakely was the lead author on and presented at ASCO back in the spring of 2023. That study was resulted and was positive for the event-free survival endpoint. And what was interesting about that trial is that overall survival, which is really, as you mentioned, we're aiming for cure in these patients. And so overall survival was included as the second dual endpoint in that trial. And I had the fortune of presenting the results at ESMO in the late fall of 2023. And of all of the neoadjuvant strategies or perioperative strategies that have ever been tried in the last 3 years, it's the first time in the last 30 years that we have a trial that is positive for overall survival and the intent to treat population. So that perioperative approach is now associated with this overall survival benefit, which is exactly what we're aiming to achieve for patients.
Very important, yeah. 'Cause my reading showed that some of the people against the use of the neoadjuvant, saying that patients sometimes become inoperable because of the delay, or they suffer side effects from the treatment and can't have the surgery. That did not seem to pan out in a significant number of cases.
Well, the problem we have is that the perfect study would have included a group that went directly to surgery, did not receive a neoadjuvant treatment, went directly to surgery, and then were offered these immunotherapies in the postoperative setting. We do not have that trial. That trial does not exist. There are academic groups that are discussing trying to do a comparison now of a pure neoadjuvant, so preoperative chemo immunotherapy followed by surgery and observation versus perioperative. And in fact, some people are looking at comparing those to upfront surgery followed by adjuvant treatment. The sad reality is a trial like that will take another 5 to 10 years to produce results. And so we'll have to make decisions in the interim. So to your point, on this notion that giving a preoperative systemic therapy to a patient who is potentially resectable, that day that you're seeing them might create a scenario where their disease progresses and now they can't have surgery. I understand the concern. It makes a lot of sense, say, from a patient's perspective, that they might be missing this window of opportunity to get a cure. Where that logic is flawed is that when you resect that patient, so many, as you mentioned early, will have a recurrence. So is it really an opportunity for cure if you're exposing them to all the risks of the operation and a high proportion won't derive benefit, will have a progression anyways, and now they're depleted as a result of having had this operation that removes functional lung and is is quite impactful on their quality of life. So what I try to explain to patients when they see me and they say, "Well, why don't you just take it out now? Like, get it out of me. I want it out." Makes sense. is that if I tell them, if you're one of those unfortunate people who has a progression on this most active of treatments that we have, this is, chemoimmunotherapy is the standard of care for most metastatic patients because of its high efficacy rate. If you happen to be one of those people who progresses on that, it is very unlikely that having undergone an operation would have been of benefit to you. And in fact, in some ways, we're saving you the pain and suffering and risks related to a potentially unhelpful operation. That's a, sometimes a hard thing to explain to people and to, for them to wrap around their heads, because you're always thinking the optimistic view that the surgery will cure and everything will be okay. But I'm not, I'm still,
No, that's
early in my career, but I've seen that that's not always the case, right?
no,
So.
no. That's a very good answer because some the reason I asked that many patients will look at the delay in surgery as not an ideal situation, but you explained it very well as to what the benefit is of that delay in this setting. So thank you for that perspective. Now, we know that a number of new lung cancer patients often have biomarkers done in order to direct their initial therapy, and I think when I last checked the National Comprehensive Cancer Network guidelines and about the importance of tumor testing, there were about 11 specific targeted mutations with specific therapy recommendations, both for first and second line options, as well as the addition of immunotherapy markers like PD-1 and PD-L1. Can you speak to the significance of these biomarkers when it comes to decisions around therapies? And in my readings, I came across things such as the tumor mutational burden or circulating tumor DNA. Do you use those in your practice to help categorize patients?
Yeah, this is really a critical thing because this concept of reflex testing or these assays, this molecular or biological characterization of the tumor being done automatically once a biopsy is generated is just not pervasive worldwide, right? I know for a fact in the US, there are a lot of places that don't have access to this,
Exactly.
particularly for early stage patients. Now, it's vitally important. There's a paper that came out actually from the metastatic setting that was retrospective, but it did show that patients who had next generation sequencing and molecular data prior to initiation of their systemic therapy had better overall survival than those who did not have that information available. And that makes a lot of sense because not all lung cancers are created equal, and not all of them will respond to the same types of treatments. And sometimes exposing them to one type of treatment might cause the next one, which is the correct one that they should have been on in the first place, to be more toxic as a result of the interactions with that prior exposure. So when I work in Quebec, okay, it's a publicly healthcare, publicly funded healthcare system, certainly not as fortunate as a lot of places around the US, and delays are significant. But I always try to explain to the patient that this, I understand the urgency to get to treatment, but the real urgency is to get to the right treatment, and that time spent to get the necessary information to adjudicate the correct treatment is vitally important. And in early stage, we've talked about immunotherapy as this new and exciting option that improves survival, but it's not the only innovation. We have the ADAURA trial, which offers the opportunity for patients to get postoperative targeted therapy to in the context of lung cancers that have mutations in the EGFR gene, and that is associated with a very important overall survival benefit. There's the ALINA trial that was presented at ESMO that shows very important benefits in terms of disease-free survival when patients get access to targeted therapy for the ALK alteration that can be present in a fair number of lung cancers. And all of these interact quite poorly with immunotherapy. And by the way, if you have one of these mutations, you tend not to respond well to immunotherapy. So you can easily expose yourself to all of the risks and basically waste a bunch of time and energy and incur risk by embarking on a treatment that's not well suited to your tumor. And so it is vitally important to have that information. And with respect to the PD-L1, it is important to have it so that you understand the likelihood of response, and how the treatment might potentially benefit or not that patient. I don't really use it as a decision tree, the PD-L1, because I see benefit across all the strata,
Got it.
just not the same magnitude of benefit, but it is still valuable. It is informative to guide patient care. With regards to TMB and T cell infiltration and a whole bunch of other biomarkers, I don't think they're related, to be honest. We probably need to build better data sets on those, especially in the early stage. And there's significant cost to generating some of these biomarkers, so we have to be mindful of that. So I think for the time being, assessing at a bare minimum, EGFR status, ALK status, and PD-L1. That's the bare minimum. But these other gene targets are important because there are other genes that, when mutated and driving the lung cancer, we know that immunotherapy is not a great option. You may choose a different path for those patients. So
Exactly.
a lot to consider.
Yeah. Now, your perspective in this is great because we know the changing landscape of lung cancer treatment over the last 10, 15 years has been significant with the mutation targets, the PD-L1 markers, and certainly now the advancements in the kind of surgery and adjuvant therapy. So where do you think, as a surgeon, lung cancer therapy is going over in the next few years? What do you expect to see or what do you hope to see with regard to treatment options?
Like we've said it's super exciting for us as clinicians to see all these opportunities emerge. For patients, it's just as distressing as ever to receive the diagnosis and have to deal with all of the unknowns. Where are we going? We're just heading into a cloud of complexity where we have a ton of options that will emerge. We have the challenge of lung cancer becoming, it's one of the most commonly diagnosed cancers. It's the highest cause of lethality in amongst all cancers, but it is a collection of rare diseases. And getting appropriate comparisons of the available therapeutic options in each of those distinct biological categories is going to be a massive challenge. To do and will require global cooperation. But for me, the destination and what I find most exciting is what's come out of some of these trials. When a patient gets a complete pathological response to chemoimmunotherapy, their overall survival, right now we have 3-year data, but like I said, it'll mature. 95% of them are alive. So if you apply the right systemic treatment and you're able to eradicate the cancer with that, and for now at least, we still need to confirm with surgery, that is extremely good news for the patient. It can de-escalate the surveillance to some extent, reassures them that they're not living with a blade over their head, that the cancer is going to come back because the statistics are so promising. And in my mind, I do some science and stuff. This is the goal. This is what we need to be targeting. We need to think of this almost in the same terms as we think of treating pneumonia. You get a culture, you know what the response to an antibiotic that bug has, and you give them the treatment until you don't see a pneumonia in the lung anymore. And it could be imaginable where we're treating some early stage lung cancers in that fashion, and then not having to expose patients to the morbidities of some of the local treatments that exist for them. So I think it'll be a rapidly shifting landscape with tons of good opportunities for patients.
Yeah, I mean, you basically are saying that precision medicine, again, overused term, but it's exactly what we want to do is the right drug at the right time for the right patient. So that's great. So I want to thank you again for joining us today. As I said at the top of the interview, we have an archive of some other lung cancer discussions on our show. These feature Dr. David Cook, a thoracic surgeon at University of California, Davis, Dr. Carla Lamb at Lahey Clinic, who spent several decades around bronchoscopy therapy, and Dr. Carolyn Presley, Ohio State University, who spoke on lung cancer treatment as a medical oncologist. So we add to this list Dr. Spicer, our thoracic surgeon, who's given us a perspective on neoadjuvant therapy. So thank you again today.
Thanks so much for this. Appreciate
be
it.
Be sure again to subscribe and rate Lungcast on your preferred listening or watching platform, and visit lung.org and hcplive.com for more news and resources. And until next time, I'm Dr. Albert Rizzo reminding you that if you can't breathe, nothing else matters.